Okay, can we put that there? Because that's too close.
Like where?
That should go there. Please.
Very long piece.
Yes. Sorry.
There you mean.
Over there on that table. And not pointing toward me. Yeah. So, Edward is there, and we're moving with the microphone,
okay,
which is not very a lot of fun. he's getting seasick now, perhaps.
Yeah, it's supposed to come
yeah.
here.
It's
okay.
Ah.
So we can move like this. Okay. So everyone, there is somebody at this moment. if you can turn your chairs. And so there's someone at this moment in Padua in Italy. His name is Edward Marin, and he works for COSIC, which is the department where Sera also works. And COSIC is one of the departments where Thomas referenced to. And it's the department of the CAUEL which works on privacy and security. Edward, can you hear me, Edward, what I'm saying?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
And Edward did a PhD quite some years. He researched medical devices. I'm thinking of something I didn't do. So my computer was misbehaving, and I've not downloaded the PDF yet. So I'm going to ask someone who has internet, which is nobody, to email. Seda, can you connect to the projector?
No.
Yeah. That's okay, because then we can look at the slides projected and talk to Edward.
Is he just seeing the
ceiling?
Oh, do you see just the... Well, you see just the ceiling. That's but that's not possible.
But the webcam is probably...
The cameras are not...
Is there a computer?
It's
yes.
a computer?
Yeah.
Oh, it's this one. No. Martino, he's
maybe
only seeing the ceiling,
no,
so it's frozen.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
But it's not one by one. It's frozen right now.
Sorry?
I see some faces, but it's frozen.
Ah.
It's not working.
Okay, Femke, can you talk a little bit more about your work, and then in the meantime, I mean to say, like, introduce the devices you've worked on, and in the meantime I will send the PDF to Sida.
So, as you said, my name is Eduard Marin. I've done my PhD in COSIC, so I joined COSIC in 2012 as a master's thesis student. I did my master's thesis on hacking a pacemaker. So during my master's thesis I did lots of experiments, but I didn't succeed. And then at the end of my master's thesis, the COSIC offered me to do a PhD. And I started my PhD in 2013. I decided, together with my supervisors, to do the PhD on security and privacy of medical devices. And during the last 4 years and a half, more or less, I've been looking at this field both from the attack point of view and also from the countermeasures point of view. So I've been trying to hack some medical devices, and I've also been trying to propose countermeasures to solve these problems. And now, currently, I'm a postdoc in COSIC, but I'm visiting a research group in Padua. And I'm working on a completely different thing now.
So you changed from the medical devices to something else?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Because I wanted to learn something else.
Yeah.
And still one of my main interests is on wireless security. Mm-hmm. Within the wireless security domain, medical device security is a very important field. Mm-hmm. But now I went from wireless networks to wired networks.
Okay.
So now I'm doing research on a new network paradigm that is known as SDN, software defined networking.
So I think you, if I understood it correctly, you worked on four devices.
Three devices.
Okay. Because on the slides there was a fourth one, so that's why.
Indeed.
Yeah. The first one is a pacemaker defibrillator. So a pacemaker is something that takes care of a heart rhythm that follows it. A defibrillator is with an extra plus.
Yeah.
It can also give your heart shocks. So it follows your heart rate, and if your heart would stop, it will shock it. The second device is
an insulin pump.
An insulin pump, which works wirelessly. So you can control the insulin pump with a little remote control.
They all work wirelessly. Pacemakers also work wirelessly.
Yeah. And the third device is a neural probe for Parkinson patients, if I understood it correctly.
Yeah, it's for Parkinson, for any type of movement disorders.
Mm-hmm.
Also like something like dystonia. There are some studies that are also showing that these devices can be used to treat severe depression.
Yeah, okay.
So they have the potential to be used in many different, to treat many different diseases.
Okay, so two of the three devices give electrical shocks, basically. Yeah,
yeah, one to the heart and one to the brain.
Yeah. Sorry. you have to see our setup. It's because the Ethernet port we got from the technical service is at the back of the room,
okay.
And now the the projector is at the front of the room. So people have to turn their heads a bit. In the meantime, we have the PDF up and running.
Okay.
So I don't know, would you like to go through the slides or?
How much time do we have?
At some point we will just bring in some food, so
yeah.
we have
At some times we will munch, but not too loudly. So I don't know. I hope, it's a very good microphone though. It's up to you.
I can introduce the topic very quickly and then I can get some questions from your side, maybe?
Yeah, super. Yeah. So now we have to do some contortionist neck things here. So for us to see the slides, we have to turn our heads.
Okay, so yep. If you can see the slides, I can go through them. So, dural is one of the most important implantable medical devices these days. And one of the things that makes this are interesting is that during the last few years, implantable medical devices have evolved significantly, both externally and internally. So manufacturers have taken important steps toward reducing the size and the weight of these devices. And at the same time, these devices have become more complex and interconnected. So now these devices can talk to different devices. And also they have got more software. So now these devices critically depend on this software to perform their action. Okay? So of course, the recent development in these medical devices bring lots of benefits for patients. So for instance, the fact that there is a wireless interface allows doctors to remotely reprogram and monitor these devices without needing to perform surgery on these patients. But at the same time, this also opens the door for attacks to perform, for hackers to perform attacks. Okay? Now I'm in slide number three.
Slide three.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's also important to know why someone would want to hack an implantable medical device, and now I'm going to slide four. There are several reasons. One reason, obviously, would be to threaten, bribe, or hurt, or kill someone. And you may think that this is a bit far-fetched, but A few years ago, the former vice president of the US, Dick Cheney, already thought that this could be used to kill him. So he asked his doctor to disable the wireless interface of his pacemaker. And also there are some other examples that show attacks against patients in other similar scenarios. So for example, in 2007, a group of criminals managed to hack a website that was intended for people with epilepsy. These hackers uploaded animated images with flashing colors in an attempt to induce seizures to these patients.
Oh, wow.
So I think that it's clear that there will be people trying to do all these things. Okay, now I'm going to slide 5. But in addition to this, there are also some other reasons. So maybe, I mean, this is a industry that generates and produces a lot of money. And there are a few manufacturers that dominate all this market. So maybe another possible reason would be to try to influence the stock market or discourage patients from using certain devices. So if you have a company, you may want patients to choose your device instead of someone else's device, right? So I think that this is also an important reason why maybe someone could hack a pacemaker or any other type of medical device. And actually, there is an example that shows that this is something that could happen in reality. In 2016, a team of researchers called MedSec claimed to have investigated the security of several cardiac devices from St. Jude Medical, which is now Abbott. Their study revealed that these devices had serious security vulnerabilities, but instead of notifying their findings to this company, following the responsible disclosure guidelines as we did in our work, they released a report jointly with another company, and this company is an investment firm. It's called Muddy Waters. So the goal of doing this was to make...
That's nice. Yeah. after the clean room, it's a good name.
Yeah. So essentially, these two companies agreed to make profit of a fall in shares, in the stock market value of the shares of St. Jude Medical. Okay, and actually the report caused the shares to fall 10%, which is quite a lot. Okay, I'm going to slide number 6 very quickly.
Yeah.
So of course privacy is also another big concern here. So all these medical devices now transmit information wirelessly. And this information is highly sensitive because it reveals the patient's health status. It may reveal some unique identifiers that could be used to track people. So I think that we all know, and probably you even more, that this data can be abused in many ways. So for instance, it could be used to infer which places a patient visited or to learn his movement patterns, which is something that we all want to hide from others. Now, I want to go to slide number 7, and I want to give you the big picture of how these devices are connected with the outside world. So, most medical devices have two different interfaces. So they have a wireless interface, and they also have an analog interface. So these are the two possible ways how they interact with the outside world. Through the wireless interface, they typically communicate with the device programmer. A device programmer is a sort of computer that the doctor has in his office and can send commands to the implantable medical device in order to reprogram its settings without needing to perform surgery on the patient. Through the programmer, doctors can also collect the data that is measured by the device, and this data can then be used to create or to adjust the therapy of the patient. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
In some cases, patients are also given a sort of base station for collecting data from their medical devices and sending this data to the hospital while they are at home. But this is kind of optional, so this is not always there.
Is that done more through apps and that kind of stuff, or no?
Well, it's a sort of modem. It's a sort of router that you put next to your bed.
Okay.
I mean, normally they do this while the patient is sleeping.
Okay. And information. Yeah.
And is this happens all the time, or is it very exceptional that this happens?
Normally, they do this once per day.
Yeah. Okay. So, but like many patients have this situation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. That's quite common. Then, I mean, all this data, as you can see in the picture, is sent to servers. It can also be accessed by users and doctors. Okay. This is quite clear. But then, medical devices also have some internal sensors, which are used to constantly measure physiological signals in the patient's body. By measuring these signals, they can detect abnormal situations and actuate accordingly. So for instance, this allows a defibrillator to deliver an electric shock when the patient's heart is not beating correctly, okay? But it turns out that this kind of interface can also be exploited to perform malicious attacks. So someone may trick the pacemaker into thinking that the heart is not beating correctly, when actually it does. And with the purpose of delivering a high voltage shock to the patient. Okay? So in my research, I mainly focus on wireless attacks. So on the first type of attack I explained. Now I'm going to slide number 9. So in this kind of attacks, the goal of the adversary is, one of the goals of the adversary might be to intercept the messages exchanged between the medical device and the device programmer, for instance, to compromise the patient's privacy. And of course, another possible goal of the adversary might be to try to impersonate the legitimate device programmer to send malicious, crafted messages to the medical device. Okay. I mean, the consequences of doing this kind of attacks can be quite serious, because if the adversary succeeds in impersonating a device programmer, he could, for instance, send an electric shock to the patient, he can give a high insulin dose, he can prevent the patient to move, speak, or even kill him. So these are the slides I wanted to use to introduce the topic. I also have some backup slides to answer some of the questions you have. Mm-hmm. But maybe now you can ask me questions and I will decide which slides I show or,
yeah. Yeah.
Or not.
Yeah. Everybody is very quiet and listening.
Which is good.
Yeah. Does anybody have? Yeah, I think now Josep is here and he's going to show some of the devices. Is the camera? Oh yeah, no one.
I don't see.
You don't see anything.
Yeah, I see
but maybe we can reload the page now.
Yeah.
Or unplug it.
Okay, we're going
like
to. I'm going to ask Martino. Can you reload it? And should we plug you in on power? Okay, we're gonna reload.
Whoa.
Whoa. I'm going to give you. Is it the same? Okay, I'll turn it down for a second.
These are peacemakers. Let me know, and they
still beep. Yeah. The pacemakers are here.
Yo. How are you?
Inside.
Yeah, good, good.
Yeah, otherwise, you can't shock your heart.
Do you have space here?
Good.
Yeah, boobs.
So we can. But these are already older pacemakers, defibrillators. But you see that we're not allowed to take pictures of the brand.
Of the brand.
Yeah. Just. Somebody's reading out the. The brand. Yeah, there's one thing I forgot to check out if Karen Sandler, if she mentions brands or not.
I think she mentions brands.
She mentions brands,
yeah.
Yeah. I watched it 2 months ago, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I briefly looked at the document and I saw some names.
Yeah.
It's just that Medtronic is such a generic name that can be anything.
Is this the device you mentioned that is next to you when you sleep?
The basic station. This is what the patient has installed at home.
Okay.
So this is it.
And this is also connected to the internet.
Yeah.
And so do people have to put it on their device, like what Martino is doing? Yeah.
So this is to activate the device.
Oh yeah.
Where is your heart? Do you have a heart?
Where does it go?
So in many cases, the pacemaker needs to be activated first.
Okay.
And this activation procedure normally takes place with a short range communication. And that's why you need to place the programming head, so what Martino has in his hands. This needs to be placed very close to the pacemaker for a few seconds.
Yeah.
And then it is activated. And then the pacemaker can communicate to a long range. Which
okay.
Means 2 or 5 meters.
2 or 5 meters.
Wow.
And the batteries?
There's a batteries inside.
There is a battery,
No.
So there is a battery inside. Probably, if you can see the pacemaker that is open, you will see the battery.
That's the battery, That's the battery.
Yeah.
It's lithium ion,
it's
I think.
Yes.
And they can also explode,
If
you don't properly. So
you could actually, a hacker could explode your lithium battery in your body.
And your heart.
How would you do
it? Something I want to say is that even though the communication takes place between 2 to 5 meters, the hacker can always extend this range. So this is the legitimate range of this communication. But adversaries can also absorb this data, so that can also listen to the wireless channel and capture these messages from far away.
Mm-hmm.
And they can also send signals with more power to be able to reprogram the device from far away. So you shouldn't see it as, this is the maximum distance from which I can have my pacemaker hack, because this can be extended.
I want to take care of some protocol. One person at a time, and we have to...
Okay. No way. What Soros did, because he asked to have an open source pacemaker with open source software, so there's no use at all.
It doesn't exist.
Soros did it.
Who's Soros?
Soros, this this big they're very rich guy that supports open source software. Openness and all those things. So he was very afraid of having this pacemaker hacked.
Mm.
So he made an open source,
pacemaker.
He let it make pacemaker.
Okay.
But if I understand you, like if you can hack from
long
like
distance.
Long range, doesn't matter if you have a closed source of open source.
No. This is not correct. So the security is based on the fact that there is cryptography or not there, okay? So it can be closed. I mean, open source doesn't necessarily mean better than closed source, okay? I mean, normally, if more people get to see what's going on in the device, it's a good sign because it improves transparency, and it can be verified by more people. But in both cases, you need to have cryptography. So cryptography is the science of protecting the information, okay? So you need to have cryptography, you need to have cryptographic keys, and you need to secure this wireless communication in both cases.
And I think...
The problem of the closed source designs is that sometimes they give a fake sense of security, because people think that these are... I mean, the people designing this think that no one will be able to learn how these things work, because they don't have the specifications. And actually, this is not true.
Yeah.
And this is, I think, this is even worse than not having security, because it gives a fake sense of security to people, and they may do some security sensitive operations that they may not do if they knew that the devices were insecure. So, for instance, if you would know that WhatsApp is insecure, you may not send naked pictures to your boyfriend or girlfriend. But if you know it's secure, you may do it, and then if it turns out that it's not secure, you have done it.
Edu, this is Seda. Hi.
Hello.
And it's awesome that you're with us. Thank you so much. I know you're at a conference, and it's so nice to see you. We miss you here a lot. But I know that you've done some amazing work to secure the channel between the defibrillator and the base. And I know that you were also looking at some data that was collected from the brains of mice to see if they have enough entropy to generate keys. Now, I've said a lot of technical stuff, and I'm wondering if you could take a few minutes to talk about the solutions and why you went in this direction.
Can I?
Wait,
because
just one second.
Because I know one of the slides.
Ah.
So I think it's good to first see what you captured, how you captured it, and what the problem is, and then we can go to,
Okay, so you're talking more about the attack part now.
I'm talking about how you listened in on the devices and that you discovered that it's not encrypted.
Okay.
Yeah,
then you can go to slide 11, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. And it's the first extra slide.
Yeah. So it's the you see it, huh? Oh, sorry, I'm not a good VGA.
I can see it, but I kind of remember what I put there.
Okay.
So in this slide, you can see several devices that I used for intercepting the messages and also for transmitting these messages. So these are, I mean, these devices are software-defined radios. So it's a device that can be reused for many different applications. Okay, now I can see the projector. Okay. So the good thing of these devices is that you can buy them and then you can reuse them for many different applications. Okay, because you program them in software and you can reprogram them in different ways. So for instance, you can program them to listen in one specific frequency, you can program them to modulate the data in a certain way. And they cost a few hundred euros, so they are quite cheap, I would say. And then I think in the picture you can also see some of the antennas we designed.
Yes.
So in some cases we use some antennas that are already that people can find in the market. But in some other cases we had to make our own antennas because of some problems we had with existing antennas. So as you can see in the pictures, using very simple components. I mean, it's a pity that that I cannot be there, because otherwise
yes.
I could show the one in the left, which is quite impressive. But I mean, you can see that with very cheap components and only a few of them, you can design something that you can use for capturing all these messages and for transmitting data. And then what we did is we connected these antennas in the software-defined radio, the white thing. And also the blue thing that you can see next to it. And we connect the software-defined radio to our laptop, so to my laptop. And I used a software called LabVIEW to control the software-defined radio. Is it clear?
Yes.
And then you could just listen in into the communication.
Yeah. I mean, then you have to start discovering how the wireless communication works. So you have to start discovering in which frequency these devices transmit, how these devices transmit this information. I mean, it's a lot of reverse engineering type of work.
Mm-hmm.
Because I didn't know anything about this communication, and I had to learn everything from scratch.
Do they use a commercial communication system? Or?
No, it's a proprietary
design.
So each company uses its own proprietary protocol. Sometimes these protocols are reused among devices from the same company, because of course this is quite a lot of effort, and if they design it, then they will probably use it in many different devices. So sometimes by analyzing one device, then you realize that your findings can also be applied in other devices but from the same company. But normally it's a proprietary thing.
If I understood it correctly, you did have, for example, for the defibrillator, you also had the machine the doctors use to program the defibrillator.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
so
you needed that to retro-engineer the signal coming out of it.
Yeah. Yeah, I like this retro-engineer because we call it reverse engineering.
Yeah.
And when you send me the list of questions and I saw retro-engineering, I was like, what is this? And then I noticed that it's the same thing. So we call it reverse engineering.
Yeah. It's in open source, quite a few people do this kind of retro engineering for document types, compression, whatever, blah, blah, blah. Yeah.
So essentially, we got one of these device programmers from one of the doctors in the Castries Hospital in Leuven. So we collaborated with them. And I kept this device programmer in the office, and I was performing actions. So I was changing things on the pacemaker through the device programmer, and I was capturing all the messages that are exchanged between these two devices. So this is also explained in one of the slides. I think it's one of the next ones.
Yeah.
Slide 12.
12.
Yeah. This is 13. Yeah.
So I was already introducing this slide with the previous question. So one of the problems here is that all these protocols are proprietary. So these companies rely on keeping the protocol specification secret as their only means to provide security. So they think that by not revealing how it works, they can keep it secure. Yeah. And with this, with the research that we did in our lab and also researchers from other places, we have demonstrated that this approach is insecure. And actually this approach often conceals fraudulent designs. Because yeah, if they think that no one will find out about the details, they will not implement any strong security mechanisms, right? So by doing the research, we want to raise awareness on the fact that this is a completely insecure approach, and that the only way to protect this wireless communication is using cryptography.
I'm a bit close, so I'm trying to. Yeah. Once you have done these researchers and hacks, what happens to the information? Like, where does it go? Does it get public, made public, or does it come back to the?
You mean the findings we found?
Yes.
Okay, so in all cases, we follow the well-known responsible disclosure guidelines. So this is a way that normally most researchers follow to disclose vulnerabilities to the companies first before publishing. So normally what we do is to notify them 6 months before disclosure.
Mm-hmm.
And then we typically work with them, sometimes in a more active way, sometimes in a more passive way, because they don't reply to emails or they reply quite late. So we try to help them understanding the risks, because I mean, in this case, there's nothing you can do because the devices are already implanted and it's difficult to fix the issue, okay? But we want them to understand the real risk of someone of someone who wants to perform attacks on these kind of devices. And we want to make them understand the situation or the context in which these attacks would be performed. So it's more, I mean, we normally have a few meetings with them, we discuss all these things, and then we decide with them, there is some discussion on this side because they always try to prevent us from writing all the details. And of course, we don't need some details, but we still want to publish papers because this is part of our jobs. So we try to omit some details to prevent others from replicating our work easily. But at the same time, we also have to provide enough evidence for researchers to trust that we did it. So it's always a bit challenging what to omit and what not to omit.
Mm-hmm. And do they do, when they hear these revelations, do they do declarations or we're going to change or nothing?
I mean, this also depends from company to company, I guess. Mm-hmm. But in most cases, we've been hearing that they want to collaborate, they always want to start working on solutions. Mm-hmm. And only now that I finished my PhD, my supervisor and I had a few meetings with them, and now they seem to be more willing to collaborate.
Yeah.
But until now, we had some meetings with them, we helped them understand the risk and nothing else.
Wow.
Of course, they always claim that they are already working on the new generations of these devices and that the new generations are more secure. But then it turns out that they are using Bluetooth in some cases.
Oh yeah.
Wow. And Bluetooth is also well known to have some weaknesses. Mm. And may not be the best option. I mean, of course, it's better than the current situation, but it might not be enough.
I'd like to go to Sarah's question now.
Because I need to take.
Mm-hmm.
Is it a similar situation with the smart TVs privacy? O sea, in the way of smart TVs had these security issues where they were easily hacked because their software weren't the software that runs on the smart TV were easily to hack because they were not renewed.
Is it a
similar issue or?
I think there are some similarities because I think in both cases no one would expect that these devices would be hacked.
Mm-hmm.
I think that when these medical companies started designing all these devices that are these days widely used, they thought on adding a wireless interface because it would provide lots of benefit for patients, but they didn't think of the security consequences of adding this to wireless interface.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's the same with the smart TVs, it's the same with all the Internet of Things
mm-hmm.
devices that we have with, I mean, that we see them and that we live with.
Can you remember the question of Seda?
Yeah. So
okay,
yeah,
cool.
I can explain this.
Yeah.
So Seda was asking about one of our recent papers in which we used physiological signal from the patient's body as a way to generate randomness. Okay, so cryptography, I mean, for having a secure cryptographic channel, you need keys, you need cryptographic keys. These cryptographic keys are sort of passwords, okay, that we need to keep secret if we want to communicate securely, okay? Normally, generating these keys in resource-constrained devices is quite difficult. So it's not an easy task. So a few months ago, we thought that it would be good to reduce a physiological signal from the patient's body to generate those keys. So we wanted to explore this option, and we wanted to demonstrate that medical devices could already have a low-cost source of randomness on the device itself, okay? Of course, these cryptographic keys need to be random, because if you can predict the key, the person will be able to generate the key, and the person will be able to communicate with the medical device, or will be able to decrypt all the information that is exchanged between the devices. Okay? So these cryptographic keys need to satisfy certain properties. And because of these properties, it's not easy that the physiological signal can be applied in this scenario. So not all physiological signals can be used. Okay, because there are some signals in the patient's body that are not random, for instance. Or for instance, there are some other signals, like the heartbeat, which are random. I mean, you can extract some randomness from the heartbeat signals, but the problem in this case is that these signals can be measured remotely, okay? So even if I don't touch you right now, there are some ways that I could be able to predict your heart rate. And if I use the heart rate as a way to generate randomness, and someone can predict or can remotely predict the value of your heart rate, this would make the design insecure.
Mm-hmm.
So one of our challenges of our research was to find a signal that satisfies these properties and also others that are a bit more complex to explain, okay? So in this work, we wanted to secure the communication between the device programmer and the neurostimulator. So the neurostimulator is this device that has access to the patient's brain. So we were thinking of
needles we saw this
mm-hmm.
one.
Mm-hmm.
We were thinking of signals from the patient's brain that could be used as a way to generate randomness. And we came up with this signal that is called LFP. It means local free potential. And apparently this signal is a signal that can be measured by the current generations of neurostimulators. And we also have strong indications. I mean, we cannot say that this signal cannot be measured remotely, because maybe it can be measured remotely. But we have strong indications that now, with the current devices, it cannot be measured remotely. So we have lots of meetings with doctors, lots of meetings with also like technical people. And we were thinking if this signal could be measured remotely, and our conclusion was that so far it cannot be measured remotely. So we explored the feasibility of using this signal as a way to generate randomness. We got data from mice brain. We look at the data, and using very simple techniques, because if we want to generate randomness in a source-constrained device, we also want the device not to perform very complex operations in order to generate these cryptographic keys. So another requirement was that the post-processing techniques or the post-processing software to process this signal should be as lightweight as possible, okay? So we were thinking of using some lightweight standard ways of generating randomness in combination with this signal from the patient's brain. And the results were quite surprising, because it turned out that this signal seems to be a good way for generating randomness on these devices. Still, there are some open questions, because in order to assess the suitability of a certain signal to generate randomness, we need to have something that is called the stochastic model. So the stochastic model tells you how random a certain signal is, and we didn't have this from this signal. So we have limited data, and based on our limited data, we can say that this signal is a promising way of generating randomness. And then in the second part of this paper, we also proposed a way to transport, because this key needs to be shared between the device programmer and the neurosimulator. So now I explain you how to generate the key in one side, but now this key needs to be transported in a reliable, in a secure way from one device to the other. So we also proposed a way to transport this key without adversaries. While preventing adversaries from eavesdropping the key.
Do you want to talk a little bit about that too, Edu?
Yeah, I can. Yeah.
Yeah, because I think that there is also something very interesting about what you call the trust model in that
mm-hmm.
part. So if you could also explain while you're doing that what you mean by a trust model and how it is constructed in this case, that would be great.
Yeah. So in medical device security, there is a fundamental problem, okay, that is that if you make something extremely secure, you can also make it unavailable for someone who needs access to the device. Okay? So to motivate this idea, let me give you one example. So suppose that you have a pacemaker and you are traveling, so you're not in your country, you're visiting a friend in another country, and then you have an accident, and there is this doctor who comes to save your life, and this doctor has to have access to your pacemaker very quickly, because if the doctor has to call your doctor in your country or something, I mean, there will be some delay, right? And it will take some time for the doctor to access the device, and he may not be able to treat you on time. But at the same time, if you're walking on the street, you don't want anyone who is close to you to be able to access your device. Okay? So this is a quite challenging problem, because for the pacemaker, it's difficult to distinguish between someone who requires to have access, so someone who is a doctor and someone who wants to save your life, and someone who wants to kill you. Okay? So in the past, some researchers have proposed a way for the pacemaker or for a medical device to distinguish between these two situations. And this way is slightly less secure than the normal way you would do to predict that, but it also allows doctors in an emergency situation to access your device. And basically the idea is that the idea is to use a sort of policy that is based on touching. So someone who can touch you is trusted, and it's a legitimate doctor. So the only thing that the person cannot do, we built a solution in which we assume that the adversary cannot touch the patient long enough. So the adversary can touch you, but not long enough to recover the skin. This may seem weird, okay? But you have to keep in mind that in this domain, it would be impossible to convince manufacturers to add security on these devices if we cannot tell them how the doctor would access the device in this kind of situation. Okay? So we have to sacrifice security, I mean, a bit of security, to satisfy availability. Okay? I mean, it's completely unacceptable that a legitimate doctor is prevented from accessing the device when the doctor has to access it. So we were thinking how to achieve a, let's say, effective trade-off between security and permissive access in an emergency situation. And we were also thinking that touching might be the only solution, okay? Because there are some other solutions, but none of these solutions would work in practice. I mean, one could think of having a tattoo printed in his arm, for instance, okay? But for instance, some people may reject to have tattoos because of historical and cultural reasons, and maybe the tattoo is damaged after an accident. You could also ask the patient to remember a password. But the problem is that in an accident, the patient can be unconscious, can be, in a situation that he can be unable to tell the password. You can also ask patients to have a sort of bracelet or sort of external device with the key printed on it. But these devices can be lost, can be stolen. So the problem is really difficult, and there's a lot of work trying to solve this. Okay? And the touching option may not be the best, but so far I would say it's the preferred option among researchers. So we proposed a solution following this principle. So someone who can touch you long enough can access your neurosimulator. So what we proposed actually is quite interesting.
You can get into it.
I cannot hear what you're saying.
No. We're having lots of surprised faces here in the room.
Okay.
People thinking, wait, how would this work?
Well, I mean, we have thought in a way that ensures that only a doctor that touches the patient for a few seconds. I mean, this can be adjusted depending on the security that you want to provide. Now I'm saying a few seconds because we model it for a few seconds. But it could be also 1 minute if this is acceptable for a doctor. But our solution ensures that only someone who touches you, so who touches your skin, can access the device. Okay, and our solution is based on the fact that both the patient's skin and the case of the neurostimulator are conductive. So if we apply electrical signal to the case of the device. Inside, I mean, we generate the cryptographic key inside of the neurosimulator. The neurosimulator is implanted, and we apply an electrical signal with the key bits embedded in it. Okay, and because the case of the device and the patient's skin is conductive, by touching the patient's skin, we can measure the signal, and we can get the key. Are you following me?
Yeah.
It's a bit difficult to explain
all these things
without
slides. It's like the
you're touching the skin with a device, not with your hands. The doctor is touching the skin with a device, measuring.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's
measuring.
Like the dog chips.
Yeah. So it's like the base station that Martina showed has this programming head. So you can envision a base station which has a sensor in the programming head. And the doctor can just take that programming head, you can place it very close to the skin, it can touch the skin, it can recover the key, and then it can establish a secure wireless communication with another simulator.
We have another question here.
Hi, my name is Rebecca, and I'm also researching devices that measure physical activity for my philosophical research. Two of the three sensitivities you say people would attack wearers of those devices for were not related to physical harm per se. One was for economic reasons, And the other one was to learn patient-sensitive information. I guess with all the Fitbits, heartbeat monitors, apps, I have a posture corrector, but all this information is shared with both the industry, so a company that's interested in it for economical reasons, and also for my information. I was quite shocked when I learned that the heartbeat monitor I was merely wearing for testing, not for running,
yeah.
but measured my way from home to work, and now thus I think not only the company but also Facebook and Google know where I live and where I work and how often I travel that distance when I'm wearing the device. So long introduction, a brief question, what can we do ourselves to protect these two malicious effects of economic reasons and sensitive information? How can we do something about that personally?
Okay. I mean, from a privacy point of view, I think it's difficult to mitigate all threats. Because, for instance, in a wired network, you can use different types of tools, for instance, to be anonymous, like who can you Tor, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But in a wireless network, it's extremely easy to eavesdrop the wireless channel. So even because now I've been talking about cryptography as the only solution or the way to protect against everything, and this is not true. So cryptography also has some limitations. So for instance, even if this is quite interesting to know, I think. So even if you use cryptography to protect the wireless channel, all these devices transmit signals that turn out to be unique.
Mm.
So during my PhD, I also did some work on device fingerprinting. And in this work, I wanted to prove that the analog signals that all these devices transmit can uniquely identify devices. So we did it for IoT technology called LoRa. I don't know if you're familiar with LoRa.
Yes.
But we found that the analog signals of LoRa devices can uniquely identify each of these devices. And these LoRa devices will be used in smart meters to transmit data, like electricity data from different houses. So even if you try to protect the data at one layer, then there will be another layer leaking some information. So yeah, I think it's a quite difficult problem to solve, and it needs to be tackled in different layers. Or at least you should be able to, I mean, you should be aware that you have to protect different layers to have perfect security. And this is costly and it's difficult and it may not be even possible.
And
of course, it's also a problem to share all this data with a specific entity. So for instance, now, all the data that pacemaker sent is collected by the same company. So by the, I mean, this base station that Martina showed, is sending data to the medical company.
Do you know how they use it?
Okay, sorry, just okay.
We don't know this.
Okay.
You had a follow-up question.
Would it be an idea to those more the cheaper heartbeat monitors for sport and health, you know, individual care? Would it be an idea to try and hack it so that the data that's sent out is actually wrong on purpose? Someone said to me, "You must get someone to hack the device, and then your heartbeat is three times as strong, or something like that,
mm-hmm.
to confuse."
I guess that could be a way.
Yeah.
I mean, sending some fake data so that, yeah, you send the real data and you also send some fake data.
Yeah.
Mm.
Okay. Well,
I'm
looking
at that. Well, thank you. Another question.
I'm working to shake the fake data because otherwise you can win.
So, did you hear the question?
No. I couldn't hear.
So she's proposing like an algorithmic a way of shaking the data, so it's not you having to shake it, but there would be some kind of way of doing that automatically.
But then if someone knows the way, that can also be reversed. I don't think that would solve the problem. I mean, this would probably add some noise in the data, but these companies would also find a way to filter out the noise and get the real data.
How can we send fake data then? How can we predict fake? How do you make this?
Actually, this is a bit more difficult than it seems because there are some regulations that may not allow you to hack devices for doing these kind of things. I mean, you can do, I mean, for instance, you can hack a device for research purposes, but this is not, I'm not sure if this can be seen as research or you're trying to send, I mean, you can hack your own device in your own lab. And for instance, in my case, I was not interacting with the servers of this company. So I was doing it in an isolated way. But if I start sending data to them, big data, I'm not sure if this is something that, from a legal point of view, you can do.
There are two things that I know that at this university people are working on. So one is Edo Balsa, who's around the corner finishing his thesis. He's working on what's called obfuscation. So basically trying to find mathematical means to improve the kind of noise that you send so that it's harder to detect, because otherwise, as you say, it's very easy just by virtue of observation and seeing the outliers to remove the noise and to get to the so-called actual data. The other thing I think that is now legally being considered, as more software and devices are data centric, is there a liability concern with respect to data? So there's a lot of work that shows that you can easily confuse the machine learning algorithms by feeding it wrong data or poisoning the data set or somehow trying to manipulate the model so that it accepts data that it shouldn't accept, etc. And so now this is becoming a legal concern as to whether data sets are a liability, and if that's the case, who can send in, and what does it mean to put false data or poison data, et cetera. So I think there's gonna be a pretty serious battleground over what is called accuracy of data, which is kind of crazy because, yeah, what is accuracy, and what does it mean that say that a data is correct or wrong? I mean, on some level, within some thresholds, like in the case of the pacemaker, maybe we can argue on what is correct data, maybe, right? And because I mean, there's a lot to be questioned in what this data is, what it represents, what the models are, how they're being trained, how they can be sometimes dealing with outliers, because maybe they should be dealing with outliers, maybe they shouldn't be clean. You see what I mean? There's already within the production of these things so many questions, and because it's going to be a liability issue, it's probably going to be a pretty serious struggle where it goes.
Wait, we have a question here? Let's start here.
Yeah, I was wondering just more about the kind of legal structures, if like these devices have some specific kind of status compared to other devices, like in terms of that there is a different liability when you hack into these things. Like we were wondering if, for example, like things like digital rights management can somehow treat the data that is transmitted as protected by that, or like if breaking them is somehow differently working than hacking into other types of devices.
I mean, the only thing I know about this topic is that since not long ago, it's allowed to hack cars, pacemakers, and other types of devices for research purposes only. But yeah, this is all I know about.
In Europe, or?
Yes, I guess also in the US. I'm not sure about this.
In the US?
In Europe, for sure.
Yeah. In the US, it's more strict.
Yeah, actually, there are some states in the US which have illegalized even for research purposes now.
Right.
That is also a battleground as to who can do this.
And research means certified research in academia?
Not academia. You can be a company that is doing research as well.
Okay.
So this is where like all the pen testing and stuff gets legalized. And it's a battleground.
Okay.
It's a legal
but also
battleground.
Would it be illegal to do it on your own device?
Yes.
I think it depends. In some cases it would be even illegal to do it on your own device.
I know that
there is actually someone who did it in his own device.
Say it again.
There is someone who did.
There is actually a well-known hacker.
Oh yeah,
who is who has diabetes, and he managed to hack his own insulin pump because he wanted to know if his device was secure.
We have a question from Marie here.
Well, we first became the distinction between.
Stop. No, but
the
kind
of I cannot hear you very well.
Yeah.
I'm really struggling to.
We'll repeat the question.
Yeah. To make fake data, that's not allowed. But then, in a lot of these cases, like the devices that Rebecca was testing, there's also not the option to opt out that you send the data away.
Right.
And that's like with the new European privacy.
I cannot hear you.
No, no, we will repeat the question.
Okay.
You should be able to use the device just on the local thing without having to send the data.
And actually, if you want to opt out, I need to send a copy of my identification, so passport, to them.
Better, right?
And I faked my birth date, so
right.
I cannot opt out because my birth date is
right.
fake,
sure.
fake
yeah.
and it doesn't comply with my date on my passport. So, yeah, throw away the app.
So, your question is?
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's a legal question. Like, is there any sort of movement to like enforce companies to also allow you to use these devices without the network connection?
I can repeat the question. I don't know the answer. But the question is, with the new GDPR, is it a legal requirement for companies to allow users or data subjects to opt out of the data being sent up the network? So basically, will it be a kind of privacy by default requirement to say your data can stay on the device and you should be able to opt out of it, or you would have to opt into the service basically collecting the data in a centralized environment?
I think that the only solution for this would be to tell the doctor that you don't want to use a visit station and you don't want to use the wireless communication.
Hmm.
I don't think there's any other way.
But the option is not available right now, is it?
It is available.
It is available.
I mean, yeah.
Ah, okay.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
You can
disable the wireless interface.
Okay, so you can have a pacemaker but without the connection.
Right, but then you probably have to take a lot of risk.
I have a response to that. So,
it's
really specific to this because Karen Sandler, she opted to have a defibrillator. Maybe. Yeah. The ceiling is not so interesting. I know, but the sound is better than video. Karen Sandler is somebody who works for the GNOME Foundation, and she's also still in free software. She has a defibrillator, and she really wanted to. Have one that was open source or get the source code, etc., etc. She didn't manage to do this, and she's based in the US. In the meantime, she's been trolled and whatever, this kind of blah blah blah. And so her defibrillator wasn't wireless, and she had to get a new device, and she looked for a company basically that doesn't offers this non-wireless way of so she just says no wireless. I don't know how you program it then, or how you get the data, but
I guess it depends on this. Maybe in some cases, in some types of devices, you cannot opt out. I think the one I looked at, you can disable the wireless interface.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, we have a question. What?
What can pass?
Okay, yeah. Another question.
Yeah, it is somehow relating to this opt-out conversation, but I would like to, because I was super shocked with the touching long enough protocol, or I don't know, however you call it, because of course, like, and the fact that it's called the trust model, like, and somehow concerned about this distance between trust and consent. No, like it is not the same.
Yeah.
The trust model as a, like, maybe thinking about possible models for consent or no. So I was wondering, like, how is this working on the side of the doctors? Because, like, how is this protocol of touching and modes of touching transmitted along the, like, this touching protocol? How is it transmitted along the medical field, and how, like, how does this cross with the trust model system? No, because it is like sounds like what they learn at medical school, and that's it. So how, like, how is this operating or proposed? I mean.
Okay, I'll try to answer the question. I'm not sure if I understood correctly, but I'll try to answer. So I discussed this solution with doctors. So we actually came up about this together with a group of people with different backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
So I was trying to explain them what I wanted to achieve. They were trying to tell me which signals I could use, or, you know. So how can I say that? From an industry point of view, we don't know if this is an acceptable solution. Okay,
yeah.
So there is always, of course, there is always big gap between sometimes research and industry. I can tell you that from a research point of view, this is a well-known problem that has been investigated by many people before. It's true that trust and consent is not the same. I fully agree on this. But do you have any other idea how this could be achieved?
Of course not.
I know, we'd be happy to see some suggestions.
A simple one, where to touch. Like,
where to touch is
the...
Yeah, I mean, if you design it properly, you only need to touch next to the device. I mean, this device, even though the device is connected to the brain, through some cables, the device is also implanted on the patient's chest. So it's like a pacemaker, it's implanted here. And then you need to touch on the patient's chest. I mean, we did some experiments. I mean, actually, I forgot to explain something quite important. And is that we did some experiments with real meat. I think that Sarah got to see these experiments.
Real?
Right?
Real meat.
Oh, yeah, the meat experiment. Yes, yes, yes.
Meat.
Meat.
Flesh.
Flesh,
yes.
I think it was, I don't remember if it was pork meat or beef.
That's great.
Synthetic.
But with the skin.
Well, I went to the supermarket, bought the meat, and I also put some bacon because there is a guy that some years ago, he already performed some experiments with real meat, and I wanted to follow the same model, let's say, that he proposed. So actually, a few centimeters of, I think it was pork meat, and then one layer of bacon to verify, I mean, to do some experiments to test if it works.
It works.
I would like to take like two more questions because we need to close.
And you still want to go to the lab?
Okay. Yes. So then we. Are there any more? Like, there's a question here.
Yeah. But I mean, it's the same one.
Yeah.
Like, the learning how to touch and the transmission of that learning and the level of encryption of the how to touch, where to touch, and who has access to it.
Okay. The how to touch is essentially, I think it's very similar to the current state right now, because doctors need to use the programming head, they need to place it on top of the device. And then they wake up the device by sending a specific message. So in my solution, these steps would be the same. And then this wake up mechanism would make the neurostimulator generate the key. And then this key, I mean, after the key has been generated, it would be transported in the way I explained. And the doctor should be able to measure this signal, get the key. And then once these two devices have the key, this key can be used to encrypt data.
Okay, but you don't count on like a cracker doctor.
No, this is okay.
That doesn't exist.
Yeah. There is no way to distinguish between. I mean, the only thing we don't. I mean, the problem here is that the pacemaker is completely isolated. It doesn't have. It's very resource constrained. It doesn't know anything about the context in which it is placed, you know? So this is the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And we're trying to give a bit of context for the pacemaker to know if it's a real doctor or not, but it's an extremely difficult problem.
Yeah.
One more question here in the corner.
Okay, this is a silly question, but do you think in the future there might be like two classes of patients, the ones that can be hacked and the ones who are secure?
Did you get that?
I think so, but I'm not sure.
So it's if in the future there will be two classes of patients, the low cost medical probably can be hacked, and the rich patients are encrypted. I don't know.
I don't know. Even if the risk of my pacemaker being hacked are lower than the risk of the pacemaker of the president of the U.S., I still want my device to be secure. And it's I think that my main concern would not be someone trying to hack my device, but someone trying to use some of the privacy information that you can infer against me. I mean, we all go to the bank to ask for a loan. We all go to an interview. This data could be abused in these kind of scenarios. And I don't want to lose a job because I have a pacemaker. And I don't want my loan to be rejected because I have a pacemaker. And we all have that, right?
One thing we probably didn't mention is that I think all the devices you researched on were in real bodies, huh?
Yeah, so they were replaced. So we were not using devices that were in dead people, because when someone dies, the device remains inside. But we were using devices with low battery that were replaced. And then these devices are kept for research purposes. So some of them are used in the lab, in the hospital. They implant them in animals and they do lots of research. And some of them we got them for our research.
Do you have a question?
Just a very small, if there is too much difference between generation of devices.
Okay. The difference between?
Generation of devices.
This is next slide.
Like a version 1, 2, 3.
Well, until now, there are...
Oh, yes, there.
Yeah, so we're showing this slide number 3.
Okay.
Yeah.
We're showing, slide number 3.
In terms of security, there is not much. I mean, probably in the oldest one, there was no need to have security because the device was completely isolated. So the device could not be accessed from outside. But then, the more you go to the right, the more security you need, because the more complex functions you can perform on the device. So the one in the right critically depends on software, and the software will have also, I mean, this is something that we didn't talk about, but the software will also have bugs, and it's also unclear how a bug can also affect the safety of a patient. I mean, the more complex you make these devices, the more security and the more checks you need. This is the message.
Edu, we didn't get to your slides about how you reverse engineered, and I think you were going to tell us about it. But I don't think we have the time to ask you in detail about how you got there. But I think for some of the questions around being able to hack our own devices, that information is actually very valuable. So could you say something about the availability of how you reverse engineered this stuff and where people could find it if they're interested in doing this work?
Yeah, so when reverse engineering all these protocols, I didn't know anything about how these devices work, as I said. So I followed the black box reverse engineering approach in all these cases. All these works are in my COSIC website. I can forward this page to you later. I mean, I didn't say it, but if someone has a doubt and he, she wants to contact me to clarify something, feel free to do it. I mean, Seda can give you my email address and you can always contact me.
Okay.
But if you're interested in reading some of my work, you can go to my personal page, or you can send me an email and ask me for something or paper or, I mean, whatever. If you need some information or you want to clarify something, just contact me.
Thank you. That's really important.
Yeah, that's very nice.
We might need some time to process the information. I propose we say goodbye to Edward now.
Mm-hmm.
not. No.
Okay,
not.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
We will for sure be in contact again.
Okay. Sure.
This week or maybe later. We'll make sure that people know where to find you. And
okay.
It's really precious to have you here today. Thank you very
Thanks.
Much.
Thank you.